Probing space and time. Probing for the truth. What is this film? What are they? From where or whence do they come? What is their purpose? Why is it happening? Why do they both reveal and lurk in the shadows simultaneously? This is the probe.
So now you know the name of the show, The Probe. We do this show once a month. It's an investigation of unidentified flying objects, abductions, and all kinds of things that happen in the sky. And I'm one of the hosts, Robert. The other host is Mark O'Connor. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. And Ed O'Reilly, who does The Sky Above. He's the expert space cadet amongst us.
These are just amateur space cadets, these other two.
So
dilettantes.
We've got an interesting show coming up this afternoon. We're going to have a live guest. His name is Ryan Stacey, and he is the provincial director and chief investigator of MUFON Canada in Ontario. And he'll tell us what MUFON is, and you'll find out. And then we're going to discuss an abduction incident that happened in Maine in 1976. And then hopefully we'll have enough time to discuss an X-File episode or two about the same subject. So Ryan should be calling in any moment.
Okay.
Welcome very much, Ryan Stacey, to this show. We call it The Probe. And I'd like to tell our listeners who Ryan is. He's the provincial director and chief investigator of Ontario for MUFON Canada. Could you actually tell us what MUFON Canada is?
Well, MUFON Canada is a satellite hub to MUFON Internet, MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. So they were established around 1969, and we kind of appeared in 1980s on and off, and then we kind of started taking it a little serious in 2008. And then we've been going ever since.
You know, the first time I ever heard the word MUFON was on the X-Files, because the Lone Gunman used to read the publication of MUFON, and they kept up on all of the UFO information and the work that Agent Mulder was doing to investigate various sightings.
I am an X-Files fan. I do happen to know, as a fun fact, that was the ninth episode in season 3.
Oh, so right.
That was a long time ago, but yeah.
But, well, you know, good news. I was online looking at X-Files things, because that's part of our program today. There's 10 episodes coming out.
They've been renewed for 10 more. Yep, I'm excited for that.
Me too. I'm really excited. Well, let me introduce you to our other two fellows. There's Ed O'Reilly.
Hello.
He does a meteorology show. He calls it The Sky Above.
And astronomy.
Okay. Not astrology?
No. I read palms on the side, but not on the air.
Okay. Yeah. And then there's Mark O'Connor, you've already met, and he does a show called Ear Candy. So we're really, really thrilled to have you on. And guys, do you have any questions for Ryan?
Well, maybe I could start. One question, maybe kind of an overreaching question. Do you notice, because maybe I'm just looking at this with hopeful expectation rather than reality, but it seems like there's been a bit of a sea change in attitudes towards the whole UFO phenomenon. I mean, you could go back 15 years ago and it would come on some news report or a radio program or whatever. And it was always nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know, you could see the almost like derision in people's voices. I don't notice as much of the derision now as I used to. And while I suppose one can't say it's become completely accepted by everybody, it does seem to garner a lot more respect. Do you find that in your researches?
Yes, mainly because we haven't stopped talking about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, MUFON was founded on the idea of being an outlet that people can talk to about these sightings. And then as it has expanded over the years, you know, people, and that through marketing as well, right? Like, I mean, we're non-for-profit, we're a volunteer organization, but we still have to advertise. And based on the work that we put out, you know, popularity grows. And then over the years, more sightings come in. That could be based on the fact that more people know we're available, or around, or maybe there's an increase of sightings as well. But then when you have so much going on, it's hard to deny all of it.
I've noticed something, and strangely enough, it was during the American political campaign. And I don't think this would have happened in maybe previous campaigns. You may have even seen this. Hillary Clinton, I think, was on the Jimmy Kimmel show, and somehow the subject of Roswell came up. And I'm just paraphrasing what her response was, but it was something like, I'd like to see what's out there, you know, quote unquote, and I'd like to see what information there is. But you know something? There was no blowback afterwards. Even her opponent didn't jump all over her. There was no derision. It was almost like a straightforward, I'd like to find out. And that was it. It wasn't, you know, boy, isn't she nuts or whatever. And that, I thought, isn't that interesting that the result of her being asked that and her response was different than it might have been.
Bill Clinton there before her was pretty heavily into disclosing things as well, too.
Yeah. So
it may be just on the onus that she was going to continue in his footsteps.
But I'm just wondering if perhaps that denotes a change in public attitudes towards the whole thing, that it's not, it's gained, at least it seems to me that it's gained a fair amount of respectability that perhaps 20 years ago people wouldn't have given, you know, it was a joke. Now it's not a joke anymore.
And yeah. Well, there's panic too, right? So, I mean, it's the fear of the unknown.
You know, like the Orson Welles broadcast back in 38.
Yeah. So there's a lot of acceptance, too, especially with different types of phenomena, not just the UFO phenomenon, but I mean, it just seems to be more widely accepted and people are coexisting, which seems to be...
And curious, maybe.
As well, right?
So, Ryan, it's Mark. You said that it's a volunteer organization. And there's also MUFON Canada. You are the director of Ontario and the chief investigator for Ontario. How does the organization function if it's a volunteer organization, and how can people join?
Well, we have a few volunteers that are supporting of it as well. So we do have to pay a membership fee to MUFON headquarters, and then we have to do our investigative training. But once we have that, we have access to the database. So everything we do, once we get in kind of type deal, is on our own free time, whenever we can, however we can. And our passion or our thirst and knowledge to find out what exactly is out there. I can't really speak on behalf of the other investigators as to what drives them, but me, I've always been interested in the X-Files. And I'm a private investigator by trade. So my day job, I actually investigate real things.
So that gives you a background on how to approach the...
It definitely gives me a different approach to open up questions and analyze stuff. And I can tell things from the beginning and all that stuff. Like I prepare documents for court, stuff like that. So I pretty much treat the investigations myself as, what if I needed to tell the judge that I was abducted by aliens? How would I prove that?
Well, that's the kind of discipline that I love to see being applied to the field.
Actually, I was going to ask if someone reported an incident, how you would go about investigating it.
Well, they come in through the CMS system. So when somebody makes a report, it gets classified through the Valley classification system.
What's CMS?
Pardon me? Sorry?
You said a sighting gets reported through the CMS system?
Yeah, the Central Messaging System, I believe, is what that stands for, CMS. So basically, when you go to the MUFON website, report a UFO, it'll give you like a form for you to fill out your sighting report. So it'll ask you a bunch of questions about what you saw, what you heard, what it looks like, physical effects and stuff. It's pretty detailed. And once you fill that out, it gets sent to headquarters, and headquarters reviews it and then categorizes it to the severity or the strangeness, rather, and then it gets distributed to their state director. And then that gets distributed to the field investigators.
Can people report sightings on an anonymous basis?
Yes, you have the option to be anonymous and you have the option to not be. We do get your information when you do the report, but if you click anonymous, we see that. And then we contact you through the means that you provided. And then none of that goes to the report. The reports cannot be seen by the general public of our findings. They can only see when you do a search what we've classified it as based on our investigation.
Do you have I was going to ask, do you have a particular feeling? This is probably more done by the main investigators because it happened there, but the Allagash case, how does that stack up with, it's fairly famous, maybe perhaps not quite as famous as, nothing's quite as famous as Roswell, but.
I know, I'd have to, believe it or not,
Okay.
I've never heard of it myself.
Okay. Well, we're going to be talking about that. You might want to hang around after the interview because we're going to be going into it. It was a UFO abduction case in Maine in 1976. Four people were purportedly taken aboard.
But Ryan can't.
Oh, you're talking about like the Betty Hill?
No, not the Betty Hill case. So that's a good one for us to for a future episode.
Yeah.
By the way, we're in our 50s and 60s, so your voice sounds a little bit younger, maybe.
Yeah, I'm 30. I'm 30 years old. And I've only been part of MUFON for 2 years, so
we've been spooking around for more years already.
Well,
I guess.
Well, they call it the Allegash because that's a part of Maine. It's a region of Maine called the Allegash. It's up north. It's not far from the New Brunswick border, I guess, in parts of it.
And no, it's about 50 kilometers west of Edmonton. But we should move on. Ryan, is there anything else you want to... Oh, I guess I still don't have an answer to the question. Why did MUFON have a MUFON Canada separate organization as opposed to just what MUFON was to begin with?
To my understanding, it was just easier to... be aware of or control things in our homeland. You know, the United States is pretty popular where it started, but then they even have offshoots in Brazil. They have offshoots in South America. I guess you don't hear about them as much, or you would hear about it in their areas, really. So I'm Canadian, and I guess it was more so an option for those who wanted to support their home base, because, like, I mean, UFO sightings happen all over the world, but I personally would like to be interested in what's happening in my back door, you know.
Absolutely.
Our backyard, rather.
So the network, really, when you think of the Mutual UFO Network, it's expanding. It's expanded into Canada, Brazil, expanding different places across the world.
We have what's called chapters. So, like, it is evolving. Again, started in 1969, so close to 50 years, something like that.
Right. You have a MUFON Canada Facebook page that people can join as well, right?
We do have a Facebook group, yeah. So it's facebook.com/MUFON Canada.
But to join MUFON and support the MUFON activities, you have to become a member?
That's not true. So you can join the group, which is free, and partake in the conversations and the discussions. When you purchase your membership, you get access to more information. So without a membership, you can see the latest 20 UFO sightings that come in live as they happen. If you miss a day and you go up the next day, it's gone. As a member, you have access to the entire database where you can look and go back in time to all the report cases. We're up to 83,000 and some odd cases right now since the CMS system has started. So there's a lot of cases.
That's a lot of cases, yeah.
Yeah, so 590 was capped for Canada alone in 2016.
That's impressive. Well, tell us exactly, Ryan. This is Bob. How do you join? And what you pay and all that, because some of our listeners might be interested in joining.
If you're interested in joining, you just go to MUFON.com. I believe on the homepage there's a link that says join.
Okay.
Join MUFON.
MUFON.com, that's easy enough.
Yeah. So, and I think it'll give you your prices. I actually have it open right now. See if it's not my internet's crapping out, so I can't tell you. I think it's $30 American. Also, too, you get the MUFON Journal.
Okay, that's what the lone gunmen were reading.
Yeah, so the MUFON Journal gets sent out once a month. I think the cover art is $6 a month. So, I mean, it actually works out. The membership fee ends up working out to be cheaper if you're getting this. So, and then all that is a report of some of these sightings, some of the findings, some information about how we investigate, tools that we use. MUFON Canada also we just started our own journal as well. That's, I think we have a mailing list. I believe, yeah, if you go to MUFONCanada.com, we do have a mailing list that you can sign up for. I'm not 100% sure how that works because I don't manage it, but I think I'm pretty sure it's free right now. So if you just sign up for that. But that's Canada-based.
Well, Bob, Ed, and I are fans of MUFON and the work that you do, and we sure appreciate you taking your personal time to join us on the show. I hope our listeners really enjoyed the introduction to MUFON and MUFON Canada and everything that you do. And perhaps we can touch base on a future episode.
Yeah, anytime, really. I can keep you updated with things as we go. And
excellent.
Thanks, Mr. Stacy. That'll be very helpful.
Thank you, Ryan. We'd love to have you on again.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye now.
Well, that was pretty exciting. I think we'll go to Clara Rockmore for a minute. I think we need a little break, and we'll listen to Tchaikovsky's Valse Sentimentale. Clara Rockmore and her theremin. So the Allagash incident.
The Allagash was an interesting, one of the more interesting UFO cases out there. It's similar in some respects to the Travis Walton fire in the sky, except this time there were four, right? Four abductees.
Four abductees. There were twin brothers.
Yeah.
And two other guys. And they were all art students at Massachusetts College of Art. Yeah, the two brothers were identical twins. That's kind of interesting. And they went up for a fishing trip in Maine in the Allagash Wilderness Preserve. They had to fly in there. And there's a whole network of lakes and rivers there. And they were really looking forward to this wonderful fishing trip.
Yeah. Except something else was doing the fishing, perhaps.
Yeah, you could put it that way.
Yeah.
They paddled their way to the lake where they wanted to go, and there were two people camping there, and they had mentioned that two young people were missing out on the water, and had they seen them? And no, they hadn't, but they camped there for the night, and then their ultimate goal was another, I think it was Chamberlain Lake. And they went out on the water the next day, and it was kind of windy and rough, but they eventually made it to where they wanted to go. Yeah, it was by that time night had fallen, and they decided to do some night fishing.
And they saw a light over in the distance, quite initially fairly far off, and for one of those strange quirks that people do strange things at the worst possible time. I would think perhaps subsequently they might be at, or have asked themselves many times why they did it. They had a flashlight, at least one of them had a flashlight with him, and signaled. I think he flashed SOS or something. I don't know if he knows Morse code or anything, but he flashed the whatever it was in the sky, and whatever it was, the light in the sky saw it, quote unquote, and started coming towards them immediately.
It's kind of weird. Let's describe the light a little bit more that they saw. They were in the canoe, and all of a sudden this large luminous body rose above the trees, and they described the light itself as undulating. It was changing colors from yellow to it was sort of alive, and they were all in awe. One in particular, was it Chuck Rack?
He
was thrilled by this, and he, I think he was the one of the four that thought, "Oh, this is wonderful. You know, I'd like to make contact with them."
So he was the signaler.
He was the signaler, and then as soon as he signaled, the light started coming towards them. And when did the ray underneath the main light sort of come down?
I think, wasn't it, didn't they notice before they even signal? I don't remember the exact chronological order of this, but it seems to me that was one of the first things they saw, not only as it approached, but as it rose above the trees, there was a beam of light coming down. And I think, interestingly enough, in the Travis Walton case, completely different part of North America, I think he and the other observers saw a beam of light come out of that UFO too. Now, what this beam of light is, or if it's another, maybe it's a probe or some kind, you know?
Yeah. Well. Anyway, after this light happened, at least three of the people in the canoe were scared to death, and they started paddling back to shore. By the way, before they went fishing, they made this huge bonfire on shore, and they did that because they wanted something to pilot them back to the shore because it was dark.
Yeah.
So anyway, they were, they decided they saw it in the distance, I guess, and they started paddling back, and then they were suddenly on the shore, and they were tired and exhausted. And they just sort of, in passing, noticed that the bonfire was burnt down to embers. Yeah. So they went to bed, and they didn't really discuss anything of the evening.
Well, apparently, I think we may have a chance later in the program to play an audio clip of them talking about their experience. And I think...
Should we play one now?
This will be in their own... I don't know who will be speaking, but it will be one of the people who were involved in the incident.
Until we get to 76. After working our way across, taking a good 20 minutes to get there, we began fishing. And we'd only been there just maybe about 10 minutes at the most.
Yeah, if that.
And the other guy was sitting at the back of the canoe said, "What the hell's that?" And we all turned and looked in that direction. And I saw this light at the tops of the trees.
I mean, this thing was big, man. It was as big as a two-story house. It had to be at least 70, 80 feet in diameter.
Slowly,
it was going very slowly, but it had this, it didn't look like a solid object. It was like, it had a fuzzy edge to it. I thought, well, let's try signaling. And Chuck had a flashlight because we were using the flashlight to attract fish, and he immediately ticked off a SOS. As soon as he did that, I mean, immediately after he did that, this beam of light came out of the bottom of this thing, and it came right for our canoe. I mean, we lit up like a Roman candle out in the middle of a black lake. So we started paddling. I mean, we were really going. And I remember looking back at one point to see where this thing was and thinking that it was way behind us. And instead of being way behind us, it was right up there. And then the next thing we remembered, all of a sudden our canoe hit the beach. And we got out of the canoe, and we stood there, and it was right in front of us in the water. I remember standing there looking at this thing, thinking that if I had a stone or a fair-sized rock, like, you know, maybe an egg-sized rock, I could hit it. That's how close it was. So it's about 30, 40 yards maybe. And there was a beam of light coming out of the bottom of it on the water. It wasn't moving. It was almost as if it was sitting on this beam of light. And then the beam went up into the sky. And it just went whoosh, like that, just like an iris closing.
We're back. So let's continue our discussion about the Allagash incident. Mark, why don't you give us a couple of your cents worth? By the way, this is 107.3 FM, your campus and community radio station in St. John, New Brunswick.
Bob just saved his job. what I think about the Allagash incident is this. You got four archetypes from Boston who fly up to Maine, close to Edmundston, 50 kilometers west of Edmundston, to do some fishing, and they have a close encounter with a two-story UFO so close that one of the fellows said it was close enough that with a good-sized rock, I could hit it. So he said maybe 30 yards away. That's how close. Two stories high. So it's a house. It's 80 feet in diameter is what they describe. All four of them, since that time, way back in the 70s, have consistently told the exact same story. They reported it to the warden because they were in a, kind of an outback situation and the garbage had to be picked up to keep the bears away from campsites. They reported to the warden the very next morning. And ever since, they've been consistent with the story. I believe that part wholeheartedly. They had an encounter with a UFO, some craft, some object of a large dimension, and they haven't wavered. Where I'm not 100% on board is their abduction stuff, because none of them remember it and didn't remember it for years later, and only with the power of hypnosis did they start to recall these details. And one of them never did remember it, even under hypnosis, and lied about it, which again damages credibility. So you'll hear that the Wiener twins, Jim and Jack, and Charlie Folger, they'll refer to the other guy. They won't even mention his name. They've come to, I think, dislike him so much. His name was Chuck Rack. Yeah. So the thing about the abduction is, if you need regression to remember, if you need hypnosis to remember it, and memory is unreliable in and of itself, it is a representation of something that happened. Sometimes you have strong memories and you're really convinced, and sometimes the memories are vague. To me, hypnosis is one step removed. It's retrieving a memory, and is the memory, in fact, real? Memory has enough problems as it is. So they, three of them that did remember stuff, remembered a remarkably consistent story. So it's worth thinking about, but it's also worth being a little skeptical about too, just because memory is so inherently unreliable. So,
well, leaving him out for the moment, because we don't know if he just doesn't remember, or if he, was he the one that had a bit of a shady background or something too? One of them had a...
Well, yeah, if the person that you don't like in the story, you're going to say he's swarthy and he's a bit of a shady character.
But did he have a criminal record or something?
I don't think so. I don't know. Okay. But I don't know. But here's the thing is he's recanting. He said, I thought I would just go along with it. I thought we'd make some money out of it. What he's saying is, look, the story about us being on the lake, what we saw, what happened, being chased by the UFO, the SOS signal, coming back, hitting the beach, the fire, all that's true. Even now that they've fallen out, they won't even speak each other's name. He's still saying that's true. He said, the abduction stuff, he said, I think it's baloney. I don't remember anything like that.
Let's talk about the fire. That's the one thing that makes me think, well, it could be true, because they lit a big bonfire that should have burned for at least 3 hours. And supposedly they were just on the water for maybe under a half an hour, as far as they knew, before they discussed it years later. But they do remember coming back on shore and wanting to go to bed, but the fire had burned down. So the time loss is one of the things that does make you want to think about it. And
well, you know, what Mark mentioned a minute ago about...
Uh-oh, there goes the theremin.
No, yeah. The all-present, omnipresent theremin, which never goes away. I'm going to smash that thing one of these days.
Such violence.
Mark mentioned about hypnotic regression, and it is interesting that, yes, it is memory retrieval, and how accurate are one's memories, particularly when you're trying to retrieve them that way. But I don't think it's possible to, if it is a fabrication, I don't think it's possible to lie under hypnotic regression. And it is interesting that three of them, whatever quality of the memories that they had, they are, under hypnotic regression, remarkably similar. So, you know, they could be faulty memories, but would they be the same faulty memories? That's intriguing.
I think we should talk about what happened in the spaceship, because one of the instruments that the aliens used...
This is Bob's favorite part, the probe. No,
that's where we
can we say it together?
The probe.
That's where we get the name of our show, because one of the gentlemen that was in the examination room remembers one alien holding a long, thin instrument with sort of a rounded...
Stick.
A stick with a rounded end.
A bulb.
Walk softly, but carry a big stick.
Now, the gentlemen are of a generation where they're fairly delicate talking about what happened to them. But from what we can imagine, the aliens took fluid samples from these gentlemen. Now, I don't know what the so-called aliens would have used them for, but they were whatever.
I think I'd be a little bit delicate talking about it, too, if that happened to me.
Well, you are delicate.
Yeah. Why don't we play the clip of them talking about what they think was done to them when they were on the spaceship?
Okay, here we go.
And then the next thing I remembered was sitting in this room. It was a room where I could focus clearly directly in front of me, but my peripheral vision was blurred. And my brother was standing maybe 8-10 feet away from me. He was standing and he was naked. And there were these beings, these kind of human shape, but they weren't human. They had a wand that was maybe 14 inches long. It was thin on one end and had a slight tiny little bulb on it. And they were like scanning his arms, and they were taking his arms and articulating his wrists and his shoulder. And I kept thinking, my God, they're going to really hurt him if they keep doing this. I remember that thought going through my head.
How long do you believe you were under that control?
Probably 2.5, maybe 3 hours. They treated us, we liken it as if you or I were animal behaviorists and we went to the North Pole and darted a polar bear and we wanted to go out and then measure its teeth and see how its jaws move, take some blood samples, maybe a sperm sample, you know, see how its limbs articulate, what's that orifice, what's this orifice, how does this work? That's how we were treated.
So we have a 14-inch wand with a bit of a bulb. So that's the probe for sure. And but he also said a number of interesting things, like how long do you think you were abducted for? 2 to 3 hours. So that goes back to the missing time that you mentioned,
yeah.
Bob, the bonfire. So let's just make it clear to our audience what happened with the bonfire.
I think in one of the tapes, I don't know if we played this one yet, they mentioned that they went into the lake to begin with, before the UFO appeared, and it appeared just after about 7 o'clock that evening. And they had the experience, they paddled back, they reached the shore, they looked back, it was still approaching them. And then the next thing they remember, the fire had burned down, and I guess they must have checked with their watches, it was 10 o'clock. 3 hours had elapsed, and both by the watch and by the fire burning down. So 3 hours missing.
Why don't we play the clip?
Okay, here we go.
When we were paddling away from this thing as fast as we could, Chuck Holtz was in the back steering us to our campsite. We could see the fire. And then Jack and I both kind of looked back to see where this thing was because it was coming towards us when we left. And I remember looking back, thinking it was still way back there. And then when I looked back, it was right behind us. And then it seemed like the next instant our canoe hit the beach.
Focused on the flames as I was paddling to our campsite.
Sure.
And it just seemed like a moment later we were on the shore and now the fire is burned out. It was a little after 10 in the evening and we had gone out onto the water just a little after 7 in the evening. But we didn't think anything about 3 hours have just passed. And for
years, we never thought about it. Still didn't have any connection at all about the fire. It was just something that never, I mean, in hindsight, it was almost as if we were programmed not to think about it.
But they didn't realize that. They didn't make that connection that, hey, our canoe just hit the beach and instead of being half hour or 20 minutes, it's 3 hours later and the fire's burned down. It was only years later that they went, whoa, that's really strange. Why, as they said, it's almost like we were programmed not to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. Because wouldn't you think that given the initial things, you were chased on from the middle of the lake to onshore by this light in the sky, you're not just going, oh, let's go to bed and forget about it and, you know, get on with our lives and won't even talk. That would be like the biggest thing in their lives.
They said we were tired, but we kind of thought we were tired from the frantic paddling we did. And it's like, well, you're, you know.
Maybe they were tired from the experiments done on them when they were in the examination.
Well, it's not a normal reaction just to lackadaisically forget and not talk about something like that 2 years later. It's almost like they were conditioned to forget.
Except on the other hand, they didn't forget seeing the UFO. They didn't forget that the canoe hit the beach and they stood there and looked at the UFO 30 yards away, two stories high. And so
actually, before the regression therapy and with the hypnosis, one of the brothers started having nightmares and losing sleep. And then he finally shared it with his brother.
Right.
And he said, "You're having those too?"
Right. They both were having them. Yes. Very similar nightmares, both affecting their lives quite drastically.
Yes. So
the nightmares triggered the whole inquiry, basically.
And I will admit that when they did the hypnotic regression, that they're saying when we undertook that, it was with the proviso that we weren't to talk to any of the other abductees. They wanted to keep that control. So he said, "I didn't talk to my twin brother. I didn't talk to Charlie Folger or Chuck Rack."
Charlie Foltz.
And
Folger's is coffee.
It is. Wake up and smell the coffee, Marks. So they insist that they until the whole entire hypnotic regression sessions, which were took place over a period of time, were done, they weren't brought together and allowed to share what the regressions had shown.
One thing that I'd like to mention, them all being artists, the theme of their artworks after everything became public, I'm not sure if they started before, they depicted scenes of their wild night in the Allagash, like there are pictures of them in the canoes, there are pictures of the aliens, which kind of looked like big ants with four fingers on.
Yeah, let's talk about what the aliens look like. I mean, I find that really interesting.
Well, especially since they were artists, they were able to depict them quite vividly.
They said their heads looked like ant heads without the antenna or the mandibles, and that they had four-digit hands, but that they were articulated in the palm. That is, instead of an opposable digit like we have with our thumb, that all of their digits could oppose, so to speak, that the palm of the hand moved far more than ours do, so that the fingers could grip things.
The better to probe you with, my dear.
That's an interesting description, though, because the classic gray, they talk about the grays, the big kind of oval-shaped heads with the big almond-shaped eyes, the black eyes. These weren't like that, according to their script. There's a different, or more insectoid.
Sounds like. I mean, and the drawings don't look the same. They don't look like the stereotypical, as you say, Ed, the stereotypical quote-unquote gray.
In general, I did read a few opposing opinions like yours, Mark, the people that are skeptical. But in general, this is considered one of the more believable and important alien encounters, really.
Yeah.
Most of the reports do say that, although I have read where people put hypnosis very much in question as a valid scientific method of finding out what people's real experiences were.
There's still this debate about hypnotic regression, but the thing that's always the skeptical point of view, and maybe there is something wrong with it, but it implies that memories can be manipulated under hypnotic regression.
Well, forget.
So
forget,
that means a manipulator, right?
No, you're wrong.
No.
Memories in and of themselves are representations of what happened.
Yeah.
They're inherently unreliable and unstable, and they change over time.
But some of criticisms have actually said about manipulation.
Well, I guess I'm saying, even if they remembered everything, the memories wouldn't be identical. The memories are always going to be a little bit different. It's been shown over and over again. If you're relying on eyewitness testimony at a criminal trial, memory is so fallible. So if you're trying to retrieve a memory via regression, it is inherently, forget manipulation, forget intention, it's going to be inherently another step down the road of unreliability.
Except, given that unreliability and the fact that they retrieved memories are inherently suspect, doesn't it make it all the more intriguing that with all those foibles, that three of them similar flawed memories? My point being that, okay, there could be flawed, but they're not going to be flawed the same way. And these are. And that's interesting. It's you look Occam's razor, the simplest possible explanation. Why would they have similar memories, similar experience?
I can tell Ed is the I want to believe school.
No, I'm just counterpoint. We don't know anything about any of these cases, except these guys are going off on the theremin again. Frustrated musicians, I think.
By the way, you guys, that was an excellent discussion about the regression therapy and hypnosis. I'm sure a lot of people...
But we're all under hypnosis right now. The audience should know that.
Yeah, so that's the Allagash incident. I think we'll have another pause and we'll come back with the X-Files. Okay, so here we go.
Oh, we all recognize that. That's iconic soundtrack music. We all recognize the X-Files.
Yeah, that certainly is. I must say I'm really rejoicing in the fact that in this day and age, we're going to get 10 more episodes of the X-Files. I did not watch the X-Files when it, you know, as it was running originally, but I came to it late and I became enthralled with
Scully.
Scully, yeah, I was just going to say.
who's Scully?
Oh, yeah, right.
You mean Gillian Anderson?
Yeah.
Well, Scully was, she was pretty hot.
Enthralled or obsessed, maybe. It might be the better word. Yeah.
Well. Anyway, I did really get into the X-Files. And I heard an interview with Chris Carter, who was the creator. And he said, kind of like me, he had the impression that the fans really loved and went for the mythology episodes, the episodes that were about the aliens and the abductions and the conspiracy of the government, and they didn't like the monster ones as much. And I tend to agree, although I liked all of the X-Files, but I really liked the mythology ones. And that is the interesting thing about the alien stories in the X-Files. There's always a shade of perhaps the government is involved in this these actions.
A shade. Man, the show is so paranoid. Yeah. even in the opening credits, trust no one.
Yeah, the truth is out there.
The one that I love is deny everything.
Deny everything, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, political 101.
When you think about the current distrust of government that you see in our culture today, I mean,
did
Chris Carter
distrust government? I never heard that.
Exactly. Chris Carter tapped into a rich vein, and you wonder, does something like the X-Files actually amplify that feeling?
Even in the pilot where Scully goes for her interview, the cigarette smoking man is sitting right there without explanation in the office with all of the assistant FBI directors, and she kind of looks at him and wonders. But he is the big representative of not necessarily the
evil.
Government of evil. Well, that secret cartel.
The shadow government.
The shadow government, exactly. But you see, that's the spooky thing. The regular government was tolerating and empowering the shadow government in the X-Files.
Helped by his trusty aide, Krycek.
Krycek, yes.
Otherwise known, you know what the nickname he got during the series
run? No, what?
Rat Boy.
Well, Weasel would be an even better one.
Rat Boy's a Canadian.
Yeah, Nicholas Lee.
Well, the show was filmed in Canada, right?
In Vancouver, yeah.
William B. Davis.
Do you want to know what Chris Carter said? He said Vancouver was perfect because, first of all, it had the misty raininess that they wanted for the X-Files. It was also not far to rural areas, and they often needed roads and woods for the X-Files. Plus, within 1 kilometer radius in the city of Vancouver, there were so many different kinds of architecture and houses that for him, it was at the absolute perfect place to film. And
cheaper plus, Canadian dollar too.
At the time, yeah. And also it was a harbor. They all often did things with ships and things like that. So
I wonder if they'll be filming the new one in Vancouver.
The article that I read about the upcoming 10 episodes, they haven't decided that yet. But that would be, well, the Canadian dollar is way down low at the moment, so maybe they will do that.
Yeah.
Well, do we want to discuss the Duane Barry episode?
Oh. Yeah.
Okay, can we all start referring to ourselves in third person? Mark O'Connor loved the Duane Barry episode.
Yes, and
I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember.
That's how Duane Barry refers to himself. Are you lying to Duane Barry? And
are you saying Duane Barry's a liar?
Are you saying, right, exactly.
Do you know the actor, Steve Railsback, played him? Do you know who he also played, memorably?
Yeah.
Charlie Manson in Helter Skelter.
That's right, he was... they were really lucky to have him.
He's a good actor, yeah, really good actor.
Well, shall I briefly give the story? Duane Barry was originally an FBI agent, and he got shot in the head. He claims that 8 years before the episode starts, he was abducted. They show the scene in the very beginning. With the aliens and him screaming and them taking him. And then throughout the episode, they show various things like him getting his little holes drilled in his teeth.
Oh, that was a classic scene.
Exactly. And
Marathon Man.
Yeah. And
Chris Carter took that from a person who told him about a real abductee that was making that claim and went to a dentist, and the dentist said there were holes too finely drilled that.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so he ended up in a mental institute because he would be violent and he'd
shot in the head would do that to a person.
Yeah, I guess so. So one day he was in to see his shrink, his psychiatrist, and he was getting the feeling that he was going to be abducted again. He could feel when that time came around. So the doctor was going to give him a needle to calm him down, and Dwayne Barry knocked him out and then took him with him out of the mental institute as a hostage, because Dwayne Barry had the theory that if he goes to the abduction site and offers another victim, the aliens will take that victim instead of him. And he was really terrified of going again. The only thing is that he forgot where the actual site was. And the name of the site was, we finally do find out, I think it's Starlight Mountain. And so he goes to a travel agency to find out that this would be in Virginia, where it is. Yeah. And so it ended up a hostage-taking situation at the travel agency.
Isn't it ironic? So the show is basically a hostage-taking incident where that's on one level. Dwayne Barry has taken a hostage. And then it turns out that he's actually trying to do a hostage exchange, that he is a hostage to the aliens and he wants to exchange the new hostage for himself. And as if it was negotiated, as if he negotiated it with the aliens. I found that sort of Hall of Mirrors, the hostage situation within a hostage situation, and exchange kind of interesting.
One thing I thought, from what I remember, the episode really got well was a lot of the abductee experiences. There's a lot of trauma there. At a future show, we'll probably be doing the Betty and Barney Hill, and there's actually a tape out there of him under regression again. And I've heard the tape. He just freaks. I mean, it's almost like someone's torturing him. And there's a lot of anguish and mental, I don't know, not just confusion, but coming off the rails. And this episode gets into that quite well through the character of Barry. It shows his pain.
Yeah. So anyway, they send in Mulder as the negotiator because of his experience. The head FBI agents in charge of this whole thing are frustrated with Mulder because he really gets into the mythology with Dwayne Barry. He wants to talk about the abduction. He wants to know if there were girls because Mulder is mourning what he thinks the abduction of his little sister. Things turn out not too badly. The hostages get let go, and they catch Dwayne Barry, and the head FBI agent in charge, who was very skeptical and making fun of Mulder, she comes to him at the end when he goes to see Dwayne Barry in the hospital bed and says, "Thank you very much, Agent Mulder, you know, and I just wanted to tell you that there were x-rays done on Dwayne Barry and implants were found in the three places that he mentioned, in his sinus cavities, in his abdomen, and the holes were drilled in his teeth." So, of course, that sets off Mulder and Krycek, who was
Rat Boy,
who was assigned to him. He and the cigarette-smoking man want to foil whatever Mulder does. And Krycek really says, "Why don't we kill him now?" Well, anyway, Assistant Director Skinner, wants to have him in the office the next day for an investigation. And he disappears. And then he promises Mulder at this point, "We're going to reinstate the X-Files." So I can imagine there was a huge cheer in North America when he said that.
Something happens at the end to Scully, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And we should probably say what the X-Files actually are.
Unexplained files, but we have a half a minute.
Okay.
And that's right. Scully...
He abducts her.
Yeah, that was one of the great points. He brings Scully up to the aliens. And it was very convenient in the life of the X-Files because Scully was going to have a baby. So that was one way for her to disappear from the show for a while. And they actually show her abdomen. So, dear listeners, we'll talk about the X-Files again.
Do tune in to The Probe for another scary, creepy, funny, exasperating episode in the near future.
That's the best one, exasperating.
Okay, here we go.
It's Clara Rockmore.
And some nice theremin music.